we had talked about the one consciousness, God, that we call Brahman, or the substratum of the whole universe. And it said, Sa eva sarvam yad bhutam yaccha bhavyam sanatanam. So that which was in the past, which is now in the present, and which will be in the future, all religions accept that, that there is a God who was there, you know, and then he created the world. The Bible says in 6 days, and then seventh day he rested. And then even when the world ends, all the religions talk about pralaya or the deluge. When the world ends, God will still remain. The world will end, and then again the creation will start. And science talks about the Big Bang, that there was a Big Bang and the whole universe started. And Vedanta has a similar philosophy. Physics says that there was this egg-shaped structure, like the size of a grapefruit. That's where the whole universe started. I was surprised to read that in one of the science journals. There was a grapefruit or little bigger shaped structure, and there was a Big Bang, which was so densely compacted, and that expanded, and the whole universe came from that little, you know, I don't know how that was, but that's what they say. Vedanta says the same thing, that there was this egg-shaped structure, and this beam of light penetrated it. And that beam of light gave the energy for that Big Bang. Now, where the beam of light came from, they say it's from that Brahman, the consciousness. And with that beam of light, there was a huge explosion, and all the planets and Earth and everything came from that compact. I don't know what kind of power would be to compact it and then to create such a Big Bang where the whole universe. And then our Puranas talk about the end of the universe, and same thing science says, that in about a few billion years, all the stars that we know will slowly start becoming faint, will lose their energy. The sun and all the stars will, all the methane and all the energy will be, and then they will all become black holes. There are some stars which are already dead, which have become black holes, and the rest of the stars will all join and merge into that one big black hole. So, but the Lord or consciousness will still be there. Nothing will happen to that. And that's what we had talked about last week. And that is what we have to meditate on. And today, we shall see how this knowledge applies to us in our day-to-day life. What is the benefit of that? And how I can apply the knowledge in my meditation. If it's not practical, then obviously, you know, there's no use to study it. So we'll do verse number 43, I'm sorry, verse number 10 on page 43. Sarva bhutastham atmanam. Sarva bhutani chatmani. Sampashyan brahma paramam. Brahma paramam yati nanyena hetuna. Okay, so sarva bhutastham atmanam. Atma means the self, the one self, the consciousness that we call as Om or Lord's presence, the self, the one, which enlivens everything, sarva bhuta, in all beings, not only humans, but animals, birds, plants, fish, in all beings, sarva bhutastham is established, this atma, this self, this consciousness, which enlivens, and that's why it makes the plant grow, makes the fish swim, the bird fly, the humans talk, and so on. Sarva bhutastham atmanam. So, okay, so then we understand, okay, there is my consciousness, that is Om, or, and then there is her consciousness, hers and his and his. So there are multiple consciousnesses or selves which are illumining, and then the plant has a different one, and animal has. They say, no. It is not that there are many consciousnesses. Consciousness is only one, appears to be many, like his consciousness appears to be separate from his because there is a gap. But they say, no, the gap is also filled by that one consciousness. And in the second line, he says, sarva bhutani cha atmani. And in that self, in that consciousness, in that Bhagavan, the Lord, sarva bhutastham, all beings are in that. So the consciousness is in me and I am in that consciousness. So consciousness is inside and outside. In the Upanishad it says, antar bahishcha tat sarvam vyapta narayana tishthati. So this Lord Narayana Bhagavan is not only inside me, inside all, but is also between us. So that empty space is also filled with that consciousness. Not only that, but where space ends, trillions of miles, even beyond that it extends. It even extends to the heavens, to the hells, to all the worlds. So consciousness is in me, I am in consciousness. It is both. I cannot be separate from that consciousness. That's why, in fact, we'll talk about that a little more when we talked about gold and ornaments. So, sarva bhutani atmani. So, oneself in all and all in that oneself. That is the essence of this verse, that we are all in floating in that one consciousness. Sampashyan, and this has to be known very clearly. Sampashyan has to be understood clearly without any doubt. If you say, I don't know, where is God? I don't see him. If he's here, why don't I see him? I don't think, this is all bunk. If you think like that, then you need to listen again. And in the beginning, this concept seems very strange, very foreign, because we always think of God as staying somewhere up in heaven, you know, there above the clouds. And then when we die, we'll go there and then he will be sitting on the seat and judging us. And we have all these ideas which are there in all religions. Or we say God is in the temple or the church. You know, when we go and pray there, we see God. My house, no, rest. No, God is everywhere. He's all pervading. That one has to make it very clear. And this concept that I am that self, the self is everywhere, is a little difficult to grasp. But this entire Upanishad will repeat this again and again. Throughout the next few verses, these ideas will be thrown at us in different forms to make it clear. Because if we are beginners in this field, it may seem a little foreign or it may seem a little intimidating, because intellectually we cannot grasp it. But he says, sampashyan brahma paramam yati. If you want to reach, know, become one with that consciousness, this idea has to be made very clear. If you think God is somewhere far away and after death I will go there, then what's the use of knowing this knowledge? How do I know? You know, after death, has anybody come and told us, you know, I died and I went and saw God? No. The benefit of this knowledge is if it helps me today. It helps me today, tomorrow, day after. Not after death. Who knows? You know, after death, we may just be gone in the, we burnt or buried. And no. The idea is to know it as today, as now. Na anyena hetuna. There is no other method except the path of knowledge. That is number one. You say, how about the path of service? Or how about the path of doing yoga, you know, doing all those exercises and penance and people stand on one leg and all those techniques like service, yoga are very good. They're very beneficial, but they are all preparatory. When I do yoga or when I do service or when I help somebody or when I act unselfishly or when I do these exercises and ritual and these austerities, my mind becomes still. And that is very necessary for this knowledge, because if my mind is disturbed and agitated and somebody comes and says, sit down here, I need to teach you Upanishads, it's not going to register. So I do some rituals, I do some prayers, I go to the church or temple, offer flowers or light a candle. All those rituals, we are not putting them down. They are very essential, but they are all preparatory. They help ultimately. Through knowledge alone you will reach. Through knowledge and through love. When you love God and then you have the right knowledge, that is the fastest and the best way to reach him. Na anyena hetuna. There is no other method except the path of knowledge. It's like in, you know, medicine, or, you know, say I want to become a doctor. Now I can put on a white coat, I can buy a stethoscope, I can even buy some medicines. and I can open a shop and have a clinic. And no, but unless I have the knowledge, I'm not going to be able to practice medicine. The same thing is physics or chemistry or whatever branch of, you know, I have to have the knowledge first to practice. That's why we go to school. That's why we go to college. So these scriptures are like the textbooks of spirituality. So they say it is a subjective experience. God is not going to, even though in our Puranas they talk about a person was meditating and then God appeared in front of him, but that's a story form. In reality, God to be experienced has to be experienced within, in meditation. That this consciousness that is illumining me, that subject, God is cannot never become an object. Somebody says, if God is there, can you show him to me in a test tube? Can you create God? No, you cannot. God can never be an object. God can only be the subject. It is the subject that knows. Who knows my body? Who knows my mind? Who knows my intellect? When I say my body, my mind, my intellect, then I am the owner of this body. I am the owner of this mind. I am the owner of this intellect. I am the knower of this body. I am the knower of this mind. I am the knower of this intellect. So who knows? Consciousness is the knower. And that consciousness illumines my mind and intellect. And then through my mind and intellect, when it is illumined by that presence of that consciousness, I know the rest of the world. Like I see the picture, or I see a flower, or I see a chair. My mind and intellect knows that it is a chair. I was, you know, told that in school or whatever. But the mind and intellect cannot function if God is not present, life or consciousness. So that one has to be very clear that it is the subject. It is not the object. It is the knower. And so in meditation, I distance myself from my body, from my mind, from my intellect, and say these are all known to me, the consciousness. So I am the consciousness who knows this body, mind, and intellect. That has to be very clear. So I am the divinity, and this body, mind, and intellect are my equipment. I own it, I run it, I know it, but I am not it. That even last time, 2 weeks ago, we had talked about. If you want to get out of body consciousness, the only way is through right knowledge. And the understanding has to be very clear without any doubt. If you have any doubts or if you are not sure, then you need to read this book, listen again and again, and then this knowledge. So without clear understanding, there are a lot of people who function in the world without any clear, there are a lot of doubts. And if you have doubts, you need to either clear them through the teacher or through reading, because without that, without knowledge, you cannot function properly in this world, especially in the field, in anything. You know, you're a pharmacist and you are working in your store. Unless you have a clear knowledge of each medicine, you might give the wrong medicine to the wrong patient at the wrong dosage, wrong time. Everything has to be understood clearly. Talking about clear understanding, there's this funny story. I've told that before, but most of you are new, so it's worth repeating. So it's about Sherlock Holmes and Watson. You know, you've heard of Sherlock Holmes was a detective and Watson was his sidekick. And Watson always was confused. And Sherlock Holmes always would solve the case. You know, Watson would bring the facts. You know, see, this is the problem. And Sherlock Holmes says, "Elementary, my dear Watson." That's his famous line. And then he solves the problem. And the bad guys get caught and all. So Sherlock Holmes and Watson went camping, you know. So they went camping and they were sleeping. In the middle of the night, Sherlock Holmes wakes up Watson. He says, "Watson, wake up. What do you see?" So Watson says, "I see the stars." So Sherlock Holmes says, "Well, what does that tell you?" So Sherlock Holmes tells Watson. So Watson says, "Well, meteorologically speaking, I see all the stars. That means there are no clouds. That means there will be good weather tomorrow for our hike." Okay. And then astronomically speaking, I see so many stars, billions of galaxies and Earth. We are a small little entity in this whole universe. Yep, you're right. And then philosophically, I think that there is this one God who's so powerful, who created this whole universe and created me also. Sherlock Holmes says, very good. So then Watson says, Sherlock, what does this tell you? Seeing all these stars, what did this tell you? Sherlock Holmes says, you idiot, somebody stole our tent. So we need to have a right knowledge. Otherwise, you know, we're all the time confused, you know, thinking about. So that's why studying the scriptures, some passion, clearly one should see, clearly one should know. And that oneself, and then we say that oneself, once you know, you reach Brahman, you reach God. Because that is what the goal of spirituality is. The goal of every human being is to reach that one entity. If you don't do it in this lifetime, you have to take multiple births until you become one with that. Like Jesus or Buddha or Shankaracharya or, you know, Mirabai or Guru Nanak or all these great saints and prophets, they became one with that. And that has to happen in this life itself. Otherwise, you have to keep taking multiple births. But one has to clearly understand that God is not separate from me. It's not that I am here and God is somewhere else. God is everywhere. We say, no, he's all pervading. When he is everywhere, then how can he be separate from me and how can I be separate from that? So that one has to understand. The example they give is, like they say, spirit and objects, they are not different. People always say, oh, there is this, you know, matter, and then there is spirit, Purush and Prakriti in our scriptures, and matter and spirit combined, and then came this whole universe, and then came all human beings. But what we say that matter and spirit are not separate, they are like gold and ornaments. Now, gold becomes a necklace, and then becomes an earring and a bangle and, you know, all those things, nose ring. Now the necklace says that I am separate from bangle or I am separate from earring, which is true. Necklace is worn in the neck, earring in the ear, nose ring in the nose and all that. So yes, all these ornaments are separate. They have different names, different usages, different shape. You know, a bangle, you know, different ornaments have different names, different shape, different uses. So name and form are different, but the essence of all is gold, right? If it is not gold, then you won't call it a gold ornament. If it is brass or copper, gold ornament is, essence is gold. So if the necklace thinks I am a necklace, then obviously necklace is separate from earring and bangle and all. But if the necklace says I am gold, I am gold, I am not necklace, I am gold, who I have taken a name and form called necklace. Necklace which is round, which is long, as opposed to a bangle. So if the necklace says I am gold, then all ornaments are me. Right? All ornaments are me because I alone am there in all the ornaments. I am not separate from ring. I'm not separate from nose ring. I'm not separate. Why? Because they are all gold. And if I, as long as I say I am a necklace, then the necklace is subject to destruction, right? The necklace gets old, then they say, let's melt it. Melt it, and now we, you know, my daughter is getting married, so we melt our old ornaments that are now no longer in fashion. You melt it, and then the jeweler makes new modern ornaments. So the gold is never destroyed. The ornaments can be destroyed. Ornaments can be modified. Ornaments can be changed. Ornaments can be destroyed. But gold remains the same. So similarly, if I say I am this body, mind and intellect, then I'm subject to destruction. The body will perish. The mind will change, the intellect. But if I say I am the spirit occupying this body, mind and intellect, then I am not subject to death. I am not subject to destruction. My body may perish, but I will always remain. Just as the necklace will perish, but gold will always remain. The other example they gave is waves and water. Now, wave only arises for a short while. And if the wave says, I am a wave, then what happens? I am a wave and all these other waves are different from me. Not only that, my existence is temporary. I am born and then I will die. A wave is getting depressed. First it is happy. I'm going up, 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 up. I'm going, and then I'm going down, down, down. The wave gets. But if the wave says, I am water, I am not the wave. I am water taking the form of a wave. A waveform can come and go, but I am always living. So then I'm not depressed. Otherwise, if I'm getting old at my body level, I get depressed. If mentally somebody insults me, I get depressed. If I'm a failure, I get depressed. But if I say I am the consciousness, these things are bound to happen. Someday happy, someday unhappy. So that one has to remember. And spirit and objects are not different. Just as gold and ornaments are not different, water and waves are not different. Waves arise from water. Ornaments arise from gold. So we all came from God, from Bhagwan, from that Lord, the spirit, the consciousness, which was the cause of this whole universe. So cause cannot be separate from the effect, right? Cause and effect is nothing. Effect is nothing but cause in a different form. Swami Chinmayananda said that in the United Nations. He said, effect is nothing but cause in a different form. So when I say I am the cause and God is the, I am the effect and God is the cause, then how can I be separate from him? It does not mean that I am God and I can create the universe. All it means is God is everywhere. He is everything. So everybody is divine. Everybody is that divinity. Everybody, just as the wave says, all waves are me. Why? Because I am water and they are all water. So I am one. So that is the viewpoint of these great souls, Mahatmas, who could see that there is one God. That's why Mahatma Gandhi even, embraced the people of the lowest caste. Why? Because God is in them. That's why Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela, all these, Jesus and all these great people saw that oneness. So that is called the understanding. So name and form are superimposition, but actually I am that spirit. That one has to, just as a name and form necklace is a superimposition on gold, a wave is a superimposition on water. So I am, my body, mind and intellect is a superimposition on consciousness. It's, it may not be apparent right away, but the more you think about it, the more you read about it, the more... Again and again, this concept will be repeated. That's the whole message of the Upanishads, that you are that divinity and never forget that. And that consciousness is the support, just as gold is the support of the necklace, right? Ocean is the support of the waves. Water is the support of the waves. And water, as being a support, can be illustrated by a very simple example. Suppose I have sand. Now sand, if I try to make it into a ball, it's going to fall apart, right? But if I fill the sand with water and then make it wet, then that's why we teach kids, when they make sand castle, we say first put water in the sand. Once you put water, water supports that sand, and then you can make a sand castle, you can make a ball and throw it, you can do whatever. So the support of everything is water, just as my body also. They say 75% of our body is water. And if the water evaporates, nothing is left. That's why when we cremate the body and the water burns off, all we find is little bit of ashes left. This huge 6 foot, individual weighing 180 pounds. When he is cremated, burnt, all we find is a few ashes, because that is only 10, 15, 20% of our body is solid. Rest is all water. So the water is the support. Water is the substratum. Everything else is superimposition. So similarly, this consciousness is all pervading. That means God is everywhere. Every cell of my body has God's presence. That's why my cells multiply. They say we have, 4 billion cells. And every 7 years, all cells of my body are replaced. So I become a new individual every 7 years. So if I have lived for, say, 56 years, 8 times my body has formed itself. So how does that happen? Because God is there. That's why they say, Kan Kan Me Bhagwan. In every cell of my being, God is. So how can I be separate? So God and me are one. That we have to understand. Then they say that when I sit for meditation, you know, thoughts bother us. You know, my mind runs. Or if somebody says something to me, then my mind gets upset. My thoughts get, you know, disturb me. And I'm stressed out. You know, I'm stressed. And then people go to a psychiatrist and take some pills and antidepressants and anxiety and Ativan and all that. You know, my mind is stressed out. Or I take sleeping pills because I can't sleep at night. And especially when we sit for meditation, you must have all noticed that the mind runs the fastest. And the mind is very disturbed. So how do I handle that? So they say, do the same thing. That what you have said, object and spirits is one, right? So make thoughts the object and source is the spirit. So I am that consciousness and in me the thoughts are arising. That one has to understand. So thoughts are created by me. Suppose I am in deep sleep, or I am under anesthesia. Will there be any thoughts? No, there are no thoughts. If I'm in dreaming, yeah, there are thoughts. But in deep sleep, the 5 or 6 hours at night, there are no thoughts. Only when I'm waking up, then the dream starts, and then the dream starts, then I wake up, then I start functioning in the world. So thoughts are my own creation. I create the thoughts. You say, but you know what? How can I create? Some thoughts are so horrible and some thoughts are so disturbing. Why would I create disturbing thoughts that disturb me? Without you, there will not be a thought. If I am not there, will my thought exist? No, suppose I'm dead. I pass away. I'm not, you know, not to say that, but suppose I'm dead. Will I have any thoughts? No. It's only when I'm alive, when I'm awake, that I am creating the thoughts. So the thoughts you watch as a witness, as a sakshi. So watch the thoughts as the thoughts arise in meditation. You say the thoughts are arising, but I am the creator of these thoughts. The thoughts are arising in me and watch them. And the moment you do that, the thought will become less. Or if I have a stressful thought and I'm very stressed out, I'm very upset, I'm so disturbed. Say, who has created these disturbing thoughts? You say, no, my husband. You know, my husband, you don't know how he is. He's created all my problems, or my boss, or my neighbor, or my child, my teenager. You don't know how many problems. They may be the cause, but what is you? You are allowing that to disturb you. So you are allowing your mind to be disturbed by the surroundings. And so when that happens, then that creates a disturbing thought in my mind. And I'm very upset and I'm very stressed out. I'm so angry. So what they say is that be aware that these negative thoughts are arising and then be watching them and say, why is this angry thought arising? Why is this jealous thought? Why is this unhappy thought? Why is this stressful thought? Why this is arising because of the circumstances. But circumstances I cannot control, but I can control my own mind, right? I can make sure that my mind does not get stressed. The neighbor may be stressful, but I don't have to allow that. So they say through practice, it's very interesting. They give a process. Like some people say, I got angry. You know, I don't know why I got angry. And then I said all these foul words and called him names. And now I'm regretting it because I lost a good friend. I shouldn't have got angry. You know, I shouldn't have. Or I should not get upset. I should not get stressed. So some people, after the fact, they realize, I should not have done that. That was a big mistake. So they say, okay, at least you realized. You know, you did something wrong. Instead of saying, you know, I was right to get angry or I was... It happened, you know, I got stressed, I got angry. Then through process from the end, then you go to the middle. I'm in an angry situation and my mind is angry or my mind is upset. So now it's not after, but during you realize, you know, my mind at this moment is angry and I should be careful. I should not say things I regret, or my mind is very stressed at this moment. I should not allow this stressful situation. So instead of after the fact, at least in the middle of the incident, you woke up. You know, it's not right. I shouldn't have these thoughts. But as you become more and more advanced in meditation and in this process, your understanding is before the thought comes. Before I get angry, before I get stressed, before I say something bad, before I hurt somebody, or before I get myself depressed, or before I go take a sleeping pill or an anxiety pill, I should be aware that this particular thought is arising and there is a stressful situation and it's going to create this stress in my mind, but it's okay. I'm not going to let it bother me. So how do you see how the progress is? One is after the fact, I understood. One is during the incident, but a wise person understands that there is a stressful situation coming. Let me become alert. Let me start chanting my mantra, start chanting Om, or start taking deep breaths, or start remembering the Lord, or start saying the Lord's Prayer, so that my mind should not get upset. And that is the progress. That is how we know that we are progressing in spirituality. That's when I asked one of the Swamiji's many years ago, I said, how do I know I am progressing in spirituality? He said, when things that used to bother you don't bother you anymore, understand you are progressing. Like at work, you know, something gets wrong. You know, I remember I used to be just shout at somebody and tell them, oh, this is why, how come you're not keeping up on time and all. But then maybe I'm getting old. That may be part of it. Things don't bother me as much. Okay, you know, it's okay. You know, it's okay. 5 minutes, you have to wait for somebody. So that is the only method through knowledge. And what is the pramana? What is the proof? Proof is the scripture. The book is the source. Book is the only way. Just as somebody gives me ice cream and I look at it and I say, I'm not sure, you know, whether it's vanilla or, you know, or some other flavor and all. So say, maybe I should put it in my ear and, you know, can I taste the ice cream? No, you cannot. Or you cannot put it in your nose, or you cannot with your eyes look at it. You have to taste it. To put the ice cream in your mouth and then you can taste and say, this is the flavor, this is the, you know, what are the ingredients and this and that. And similarly, if I want to hear some beautiful music, I cannot listen with my eyes or listen with my nose. I have to listen with my ears. If my ears are plugged, I won't be able to listen. So just as for listening, ears are the proof. For seeing, eyes are the proof. For tasting, tongue is the proof. For this knowledge, scriptures are the proof. You have to read these books. You have to read the scriptures. That is the only proof. That is that. That's why all our great sages and saints and prophets composed all these books for us. The Bible, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, the Guru Granth Sahib, all the Upanishads. So they are the method of knowing this knowledge. You cannot know it on your own. You cannot say, I'm going to learn it on my own. No, you have to approach the scriptures. That's why we cover these texts. Even on Sunday, we do the Bhagavad Gita text, you know, for the same purpose. That is these texts which will take us to this highest. There is no other way except through these textbooks. I know I went a little bit over, but this verse is a little difficult to cover. It's kind of complicated, so we went about 5-10 minutes over. But we can extend a little bit the meditation. Are there any questions or comments about this subject?
No, I asked the Pankaj Shukla one time, say, how do I know that I'm progressing in spirituality? And he goes, if your wife says you're progressing, then you're progressing.
Only you can tell yourself. Actually, only I can know myself. How this knowledge is subjective. See, people say, you know, this book is very good. My husband should read it. Or my husband should come to this class. You know, we always say that. This book is for me. I need to learn so that it helps me. It's not for somebody else. It's not for teaching. And you will say, well, then why are you sitting and teaching? Because there is no other person in this mission. So they... I'm forced to teach. But the point is that this book is for me to learn, for me to grow, for me to evolve. So I have to change. That is the only way. I cannot try to expect anybody else to change. You say, I wish my husband would change. Nobody can change. Only you can change yourself. And then if you change, then the world will change around you. You cannot change any. You cannot change your children, your husband, your nobody, your brother, sister. I can only change myself. So this knowledge is for self-improvement.
What's amazing thing is that every time you reach and you feel different, you get different knowledge. You find, you feel that you are, oh, it's different.
It makes you calmer. That's what I have found for myself. I am calmer than I used to be. And I think a lot of the credit goes to, you know, all the Swamijis and all the teachers who have come and taught us. I think, and I actually benefit most by talking, because I have to read it at least 3 times to be able to speak. I start, you know, read it last night, and then again before the class, then I make notes. So 3 times I read, so it helps me. That's why I, you know, I'm thankful to all of you that by your coming, I'm able to, you know, learn. I benefit the most from that. Actually, that's what they say, the one who teaches benefits the most. So that's another thing, you know, share this knowledge with others. If you find somebody who is interested, grab him and say, you know, come here and sit down. Do you know you are not this body? He might get bored, but at least that, but at least that way, you know, you will learn. So that's what I find. That's the biggest benefit of teaching. You learn, like she teaches yoga. So you learn twice as much because you have to practice. You have to be very good. You have to check others. So teaching is always twice learning.
Myself, you know, and that transition to become, in a way, God, a part of the divinity.
Right. Divinity. Right, absolutely. And when you meditate, that's why they say when you meditate, then when your mind becomes completely still, when in your meditation, when by chanting the mantra or om or watching your breath, and the mind becomes still, and at that time, you lose even your body awareness. Sometimes if you go into deep meditation, you might have experienced that even your body you do not know. Then you are close to that divinity, that self. And once you experience that, then slowly, slowly that becomes a more permanent experience. For the saints, it happens all the time. See, the saints live with that. All these great saints, whether it's Narasimha Mehta or Mirabai or all these great saints, they lived with that. That's why Jesus says that Father in heaven and I are one. He who has seen me has seen the Father. But for you and me, it may happen in brief moments of meditation. But as you do that, it slowly becomes a more permanent understanding, a permanent, firm understanding, firm experience. And as the more you, and also this book will again and again come, repeat the same with a different emphasis. Like next week, they will give a different example of Om, how you can use Om to meditate. So we'll be talking about that next week. So slowly by practicing this again and again, this will become permanent knowledge. If you have a couple of minutes, it's a very good example. Like they say, like heat. Now there is a fire, you know, fire has heat and has brilliance. Two things, right? Now, you put an iron ball, that's a very famous example. You put an iron ball in fire, what happens to the iron ball? It becomes red and becomes hot, both. So it expresses heat and light and brilliance. Now, the same fire, you boil water. Now, water becomes hot, doesn't become brilliant, doesn't become shiny. So water only expresses the heat, does not express the brilliance of fire. While the iron ball expresses both. So same way, this consciousness has existence, consciousness and bliss. A chair only expresses existence. An animal expresses existence and consciousness. It is alive and it is existent, but does not express the bliss aspect, which only humans can. So humans are the closest to the creation of that, because we have all three aspects.
I was thinking
right.
About consciousness being
at
all, you should be kind and
compassionate. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Right. Even to the chair, because God is in the chair too, even to inanimate objects, you should not abuse like your shoes or your clothes, because everything is that one. Mm-hmm. So the respect for all living and non-being, non-living, all of them. That's what the Ishavasya Upanishad starts with that. That is the first mantra. That God is there in all, moving and non-moving, in everything. Is there. one.